Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 379 for July 21st, 2012. Coming up in a few minutes...
The whiskey market, whiskey world is great at the moment. There's a buzz about everyone. All my colleagues that work for other companies and that are all very vibrant as well. It's a good time in the whiskey world.
Had a chance to catch up with Ian McMillan of Bern Stewart Distillers over lunch this week. It's been several years since our last chat. Ian oversees Boonehaven, Deanston, and Tobermory distilleries, and he's getting ready to mark his 40th year in the whiskey business with several 40-year-old whiskeys. More on that later, along with the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Whiskey Cast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases, and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. And we'll begin with the latest on the sale of Brook Laddie to Remy Cointreau. The contracts were signed on Friday, but look for an official announcement to come before the stock markets open in Europe on Monday morning. There have been many rumors about the sale price, but none of them have even been close to the actual price, £58 million. Or about $90 million. That would be the highest price ever paid for a single Scotch whiskey distillery. The highest price on record for a single distillery was Beam's $95 million acquisition of Ireland's Cooley Distillery last December. Remy Cointreau Chair Dominique Ariard-Dubriel and CEO Jean-Marie Laborde met with Brook Laddie employees on ILO Wednesday. Not only will there be no jobs cut, but the distillery will actually add new staff with plans to double production to around 1.6 million liters of spirit annually. In addition, all maturation and bottling will remain on Islay, and longtime Brook Laddie investor and manager Simon Coughlin will be the new managing director. Simon was part of Mark Rainier's original investor group that rescued Brook Laddie, and he's been in charge of operations at the distillery for a while now. As I mentioned last weekend, Mark Rainier will be the only one leaving Brook Laddie after the sale. It's been widely reported, and I've been able to confirm, that he was the only board member to vote against the sale. His future plans are still up in the air. Now, I have asked Mark for an interview, but he's asked if he could hold off until after the sale is officially announced. I hope to have his inside story on the sale on the next Whiskey Cast. One other key point, in addition to the investor group, all of the distillery's employees will share in the proceeds from the sale. Employees received stock options over the years as part of their compensation. Many of them stand to collect six-figure payouts as a result of the sale. Now, let's turn to Wieden Mackay, which was hit with a $9,000 fine by Scottish environmental officials this past week for an oil spill last August at the Invergordon Grain Whiskey Distillery. About 20,000 liters of fusel oil leaked into the Cromarty Firth, which is designated as environmentally sensitive bird habitat. In a statement to WhiskeyCast, a Wieden Mackay spokesman apologized for the spill and says it happened just after a major construction project had been completed at Invergordon. The company will be investing in infrastructure to prevent future spills. Now, on the investing front, the financial problems of Wieden Mackay owner Dr. Vijay Mallya have been dominating the financial pages in recent months. His Kingfisher Airlines unit in India has cut all international flights, and Mallya has been trying to find investors to take a minority stake in the airline. The Financial Times reports this week that many members of Mallya's Indian Premier League cricket team have yet to receive their final paychecks for the last season. And then there's Wieden Mackay, which Mallya borrowed heavily to acquire in 2007. There have been rumors circulating around Scotland that both Dalmore and Jura distilleries had to shut down earlier than planned this summer because malt suppliers cut off their deliveries because of unpaid bills. I asked Wieden Mackay officials to address those rumors this week. A company spokesman confirmed that they did start their annual summer shutdown at all of their distilleries early for operational reasons, but that full production will resume as scheduled at the beginning of August. In addition, Finance Director Hemant Meeman said the company is profitable with significant growth, but that, and I quote now, "Like any business growing aggressively, we also have points of cash flow management challenges, which we are optimally managing. While we don't comment on any specific case, suffice to say all our suppliers have long-standing association with White & Mackay and are our strong partners in progress. We continue to work with all our suppliers." Meenan also said that White & Mackay officials don't have any insight into Malia's affairs, but that it has always been the intent of United Spirits to sell up to a 49% stake in White & Mackay if the price and partner are right. Now can we talk about whiskeys instead of finance? Kentucky's getting another distillery. It'll be built in the Cincinnati suburb of Newport in northern Kentucky by the Lewis family, which also owns the Party Source liquor store. Molly Lewis, the daughter of Party Source owner Ken Lewis, will be the owner and CEO for Nth Degree Distilling. The distillery will be known as The Nth and is expected to open late next year adjacent to the Party Source store across the city limits in Bellevue, Kentucky. According to the Cincinnati Inquirer, the distillery will have an events center run by a nonprofit group that will host corporate meetings and special events. The Nth has already committed to joining the Kentucky Distillers Association and becoming a member of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail when it opens. The Party Source also has broken ground on an addition that will house a microbrewery, pub, and bourbon tasting bar. I mentioned a few weeks ago that Mark Watt had left Duncan Taylor, where he had been heading up international sales. He's landed now at Cadenheads, where he'll be creating a new range of whiskeys for the export market. Glenfiddich is releasing a new limited edition just in time for the London Olympics. The Millennium Vintage was distilled in 2000. Right now it's only available at the World of Whiskey's duty-free shops in London's Heathrow Airport. Starting July 25th, it'll be available at all World duty-free shops in the UK. It's priced at £40 a bottle, or about $62 at current exchange rates. Also in England, the English Whiskey Company has released its latest expression. Distillers Elect was created by head distiller David Witt. It'll only be sold to distillery visitors. Now this weekend, the golf world is also focusing on England. The Open Championship is being held at Royal Lytham in St. Anne's. Glenmorangie has signed on to be the Open's official whiskey, and their U.S. team held a golf-themed party in New York the other night to celebrate. That's where I caught up with Glenmorangie's Brian Cox.
We're delighted and privileged to be sponsors and official whiskey of the Open Championship, which is, as you know, the oldest major. And it's a big milestone for Glenmorangie, and I think a fantastic fit. If you look at this, the R&A and ourselves, the Glenmorangie Company, are both very Scottish companies, rooted in Scotland, Lynx Golf, the distillery. There's a great fit, both in terms of values and history and culture, between golf and single malt whiskey. So this is, in a way, a very logical conclusion, and something we're happy to share and bring to people through promotions such as this, where you can see we have a simulator that allows people to play Royal Lytham or as close as they can ever probably get without actually going there. So it's good fun.
But you're actually going there next week, right?
I'm fortunate enough. We have a number of trade incentives, partnerships, and as you know, we have a lot of joint promotions and partnerships with the TPC network, obviously Burley's for the Braveston charity activity as well, with TaylorMade, and the whole, I guess, the golfing community on that. So yeah, we're all going to have a few drams over in the UK and Scotland.
Now let's also talk about your new brand ambassador, because you guys just hired a former Open champion, right?
Yes, so we've got Tony Jacklin, who now actually resides in Florida, but is credited in bringing, I guess, back in Royal Lytham in 1970, bringing back passion and getting the English public back interested in golf. And if you look look back at what had happened, I guess, in the 60s and 70s, it had become very dominated by American players, and no bad thing. Mr. Palmer, chief amongst them, but also Jack Nicklaus, obviously. And this was the first British player to come back and win both the Open, the British Open, as it were, and the US Open. So it's a fantastic fit. And, you know, we see ourselves, we're the fastest growing single malt brand in America, yet we're also Scotland's favourite and number one selling single malt brand. And I think having a British golfing ambassador based in the US is a great thing and very representative. And we look forward to activating a lot of programs and events with Tony in the US next year.
You're going to have him leading tastings, right?
We may, no. I mean, we'll have him...
being facetious, of course.
Yeah, because you know that I would have Mr. Blackmore on my back right away. And then, you know, David is not here tonight, but he's out and about, still pounding the streets as he has with me on this brand for basically the last 5 years. But, no, we'll keep David doing the tastings. And we also have a new ambassador starting for the central region based in Illinois, Gregor Mina, fantastic Scotsman that we've just moved over. So, you know, the brand's starting to engage again, allowing ourselves as we grow a bit larger in terms of volume and sales to actually also come and engage more people, do more tastings, get out there, share our passion and our taste for Glenmorangie with consumers.
By the way, we're giving away a Glenmorangie Open Championship golf package. I'll have details on that in just a few minutes. Ballantine's, meanwhile, is launching a limited edition 40-year-old expression in Asia. It's already available in South Korea and will be available in Asian travel retail shops in a few weeks. Only 100 bottles will be released each year at a price of $7,000 each. Kilhoman is out with a new sherry cask expression. The sherry cask release was matured for 5 years in Oloroso sherry butts. It's the distillery's first fully matured sherry cask whiskey. It's been bottled at 46% ABV. 6,000 bottles are available worldwide, including the U.S. I've been getting a lot of questions recently about Ardbeg's new limited release, with people asking about the name Galileo. I have been able to confirm that is the name. Of course, there's a natural link with the Ardbeg experiment, currently on board the International Space Station. The whiskey was distilled in 1999, matured here on Earth, in a mix of Marsala casks along with first fill and refill bourbon casks. It's set for release this fall. Mal Blair has another vintage coming out in addition to the second edition from 1975 that I mentioned last week. The Mal Blair 2002 is matured in 100% ex-bourbon casks. It's bottled at 46% ABV. In addition, Mal Blair has created a new gathering place at its website for whiskey lovers. There will be a special single cask bottling available for gathering place members later this year. Now, speaking of the web, Whiskey Magazine has released an online version of the magazine. It's available on the web and as an iPad app. Editor Rob Allenson says it'll give readers around the world a way to avoid waiting for the postman.
Well, it's basically going to be taking the content of the magazine that you normally get, and there'll be bonus features in there where you can sort of explore the stories more, and we'll throw in pictures that we haven't used in the features, and there will also be films and audio and visual to complement your experiences of the stories in Whiskey Magazine.
And this actually will let people carry around almost over a year's worth of back issues with them for tasting notes and things like that, because you'll be able to go back and see the notes that you, Dave Broom and Martine do on various whiskeys as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It will all be there. And I think as we get further down this line, there'll be, you start to see more back issues appearing, and eventually you'll have everything searchable, really, which is quite invaluable for the whiskey enthusiast.
Now, this is going to be a little different from the other publications in that it's not going to be something that's actually included with your print subscription, right?
No, it is a separate digital subscription, which is fairly common over here in the UK. You either subscribe to one or the other, really.
But it also has some advantages in that places like the US, where the print edition comes out a month or so after the rest of the world gets it, you now actually get everything on the same day as the entire world gets an issue on the same day.
Yes, yeah, that is one of the advantages for stateside readers, definitely. You can have it, the new edition is out today, and it is on the iPad already, so you don't have to worry about boats crossing the Atlantic, which is kind of nice, I think.
Is this going to give you guys any more room for creativity in terms of design and what you'd like to be able to do and what a magazine editor and designer would like to be able to do but can't because of the limitations of the medium?
Yeah, I think as we sort of get further down the line, I mean, it's only been 3 weeks now, but I think as we get further down the line with this thing and we get more and more to grips with the media, I think you'll find that, yeah, we'll start changing things and adding more things in, and just looking at how we can play with it. And it's always been the intention. So hopefully, yes. I mean, but, you know, the bonus media side is pretty cool. I don't think we've reached the capacity yet of what we can do with it. So we're still exploring.
And if I remember correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's actually cheaper to subscribe to the iPad edition than it is to actually get the print edition, right?
Yes, it is. It is by off the top of my head, I can't remember the difference, but yeah, there is a small discount for subscribing online, which it reflects the marketplace. Actually, I mean, it's not uncommon to find that a magazine, you know, to get the print edition because paper costs and the fact that you actually do have a physical edition and postage. Overheads that you don't have with a digital edition.
As a magazine guy for a long time, because you were in magazines before you got into whiskey, is this the way we're going to see the entire magazine industry going? I mean, I haven't bought a physical copy of a magazine in months because I get all my magazines on my iPad now.
That's the death of print media. It's one of these discussions that goes on and on and on. I'm a kind of, to be honest, a dyed-in-the-wool paper guy. I like the physicality of a magazine. That said, I bought a Kindle, and I haven't bought a book since. But I do. There's a movement over here in the UK and various other parts of the world for high-quality subscriber-only magazines printed on, you know, heavy paper stock stuff, coffee table magazine type things. Stuff that you keep and you reference back to. So I don't think we're going to see the end of really nice magazines such as Whiskey Magazine just yet. I don't think that's in the running. Because there is that, you know, when you get your magazine, you open it up and it's got that smell of the printer's ink coming out of the envelope. I don't think you can beat that, and certainly digital will never replace that. Having said that, there is obviously the usefulness and the portability of having it on digital. So I think we'll leave it up to the subscribers to see which ones they prefer.
By the way, the latest issue was released this week, both in Europe and digitally. Issue number 105 focuses on American whiskeys. I have a photo essay looking at closed distilleries in Kentucky. It'll be available to U.S. print subscribers in September. Now, Whiskey Magazine was the first whiskey-focused print magazine to release a digital edition, but not by much. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Unfiltered magazine has also released an iPad version that makes Unfiltered available to non-society members for the first time. You'll find both available through the iTunes App Store. And that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Visit us on the web at glenmorangie.com or download our iPad app at the iTunes App Store. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made.
As I mentioned earlier, Glenmorangie is the official whiskey of the Open Championship this weekend, and they're going to give one golf-loving WhiskeyCast listener a great prize package. The winner will receive a special Glenmorangie Open Championship golf bag, along with a new tailor-made RBZ driver to put in it, along with a golf shirt, cap, and golf balls bearing the Glenmorangie and Open Championship logos. You can enter at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or by sending an email with your name, address, and age to glenmorangie@whiskeycast.com. The deadline is July 31st, 2012. The winner will be selected at random from all entries. You'll find all of the details and pictures of the bag and the driver at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Just click the competition tab at the top of the page to enter. By the way, the latest episode of WhiskeyCast HD is now online, focusing on whiskey cocktails with the folks at The Drink in Brooklyn, New York. There are links at the WhiskeyCast website and our Facebook page. Now let's check the comments of the week, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. Jim Manley emailed with a question about tasting whiskeys. Here's his question. Do you add water to the whiskeys you do tasting notes for before doing the nosing and tasting? I've heard different things about this. If so, do you try to hit a specific ABV or just work on a relative scale? I've been working on training my nose and palate, but I'm still not able to pick out a lot of the nuances I read about. It's got me wondering if I'm using the correct technique. Well, I always taste whiskeys neat at first, then I'll add a couple of drops of water just to see if it makes a difference. However, just as each person's senses of smell and taste are different, there are many different ways to nose and taste whiskeys. Most blenders will reduce the ABV of a whiskey down to around 20% with water, but keep in mind that when they do that, they're usually looking for consistency and trying to find off notes. They're not evaluating every individual variable in a sample. Now, if you have a question or suggestion, you can always post it on our Facebook page or email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and the comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a Whiskey Insider today.
WhiskeyCast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. In 1886, William Grant set out to fulfill a lifelong ambition, to make the best dram in the valley. Today, a rarity in Scotland, Glenfiddich still remains independently owned by the fifth generation of the same pioneering family. This unique legacy of skill, passion and pride forges a long-term commitment to creating truly great single malt without compromise. Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To learn more about our award-winning range and join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. There's a new event on the calendar this week. Richard Patterson will be leading a Dalmore Masterclass on July 31st at the Astor Center in New York City, which will also have a class on how to make whiskey cocktails on August 3rd. The next second Saturday single malt tasting at the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming is set for August 11th. Whiskey Live Australia is August 15th in Sydney. McTeers will hold its next whiskey auction the same day in Glasgow. Woodford Reserve's 200th Anniversary Festival is August 25th in Versailles, Kentucky. The San Diego Spirits Festival is August 25th and 26th. The Sydney Whiskey Fair is August 31st and September 1st. And Whiskey Lux is set for September 7th in Edinburgh, Scotland. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com. While you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Kevin O'Gorman, master of maturation, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
Redbreast is a drink that I really love on special occasions. I know last year when Cork won the All-Ireland Football Championship in Croke Park, it was a very special occasion, and myself and two of my friends, the first thing we did, we went to a pub in Dublin and we sat down and we had a lovely Redbreast with a drop of water.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
This week on WhiskeyCast In Depth, we're not just going to look at one distillery, but three. Well, three and a half. Ian McMillan is the master blender and coordinates distillery operations for Byrne Stewart's three and a half distilleries, Boonehaven, Deanston, and Tobermory. The half is Lechig, which is the peated whiskey that's made at Tobermory, if you want to count it separately for fun. Now, Tobermory has been in the news recently because, unlike most of Scotland, the Isle of Mull has been suffering from a drought this summer, and Tobermory had to shut down when its water source started to dry up.
We were very concerned this year. It's the first time I've ever noticed that the rainfall in Mull was so low. But it was due to a lot of it to do with the weather throughout the rest of the UK, which has been really torrential rain. But for some obscure reason, the Western Isles of Scotland, from Mull northwards and then out towards the Isles of Lewis and Harris, were in a drought situation where we had no rain for 12 weeks. And the water levels were dwindling down. The supply from the streams coming down was getting less and less. And we got to the point where we said, well, we're not going to take any more chances. Looking after quality of water as such as well. So we decided to stop producing until the rain eventually came, which it did do a few weeks ago. But it's not been still not as normal. In all the 20 years I've been going to Mull, I've never known Mull to ever go for longer than 2 to 3 weeks without rainfall.
But now you're right in the middle of the silent season too, so this gives you a chance to replenish the stream, right?
Well, we restarted about 3 or 4 weeks ago because I was actually there and I looked at the water supply was full and running over. We'd had a few heavy rainfalls. So the lock had filled up again and it was fine. And in the normal circumstances, I probably would have extended or delayed the summer close down period to allow us to catch up some of the lost production. But I've got quite big engineering works happening this summer where I'm replacing the brewing tanks. That was already all organised, and so engineers were all booked. Everything was already, so we just had to carry on with that. So we did produce for about 3 weeks, and then we have to stop now. So we're in the middle of production, silent season now. But we resume again late August, and we will be very much increased production until the end of the year to make up the shortfall.
So this won't affect you long-term. This is basically just a short-term setback, right?
This will be no affecting of the stocks of Tobermory or Lake Chigg at all. In fact, at the time we were distilling Tobermory, so we will catch that up, and the production of Lake Chigg planned for this year, which should have started by now, will be unaffected.
What else is happening, at least as far as Tobermory and Lake Chigg are concerned, as far as releases? Anything new coming from those guys?
Well, there's nothing new coming out this year. Next year, I do have the delayed 40-year-old Lake Chigg, which should come out next year, and perhaps a 40-year-old Tobermory. These would be very much limited and only available in certain markets. But the stock is there. The whiskey is remarkable. Super quality, so I look forward to that being prepared for release. But it would be sometime probably around about spring or mid next year.
And this would be the oldest releases from either, right?
This would be the oldest release of from these. I mean, this whiskey was distilled just after the distillery restarted production in 1972. So it's... It's also quite good because I've been looking after this whisky now for the last 20 years, and the fact that next year is my 40th, I'm in my 40th year in the industry, so it's actually quite nice. I'm going to be releasing a few 40-year-olds between this year and next year.
What other 40-year-olds are you releasing?
We're bringing out later this year a 40-year-old Bonahavan, which is sensational liquid, and it'll be... There is stock coming to the States here. In fact, I'm going over to Taiwan next month to initiate the launch of that liquid in Taiwan.
Tell me more about it. What was it matured in? The circumstances when this was distilled 40 years ago, things like that.
It's a great story because when we first bought the distillery, I was looking through all the inventory, obviously, which took me some time to go through it all, but I came across this stack of of these casks, which I recognised the company on the cask was an old company that was in Glasgow in the 70s, which I always remembered that they used to send in and good quality casks when I worked at Glengoyne. And they selected different distilleries throughout Scotland. They were a whiskey broking company, but they did have good casks. And I saw these casks, and I hadn't seen any of these type of casks for years. So of the whole store of these casks, I requested samples from them, and I was really taken with the quality. I knew they would be good, and they had been unmoved in there since they were put in there in 1971. And so I sampled every single one of them, and only of the, I believe there was about 42 casks, I think, I rejected six. Six I didn't think were up to standard, or they had lost too much alcohol strength. I then watched them over the next, until I always had a plan in my head then that this whiskey would be bottled as a 40-year-old, which by that time was 9 years in advance. We did do a small bottling of it, where I selected a couple of casks from it when we did to celebrate the Bunnahabhain 125th anniversary. We brought out the 35-year-old, this is the 71 vintage, very limited, 750 bottles we did for that. But this is the same liquid, but 5 years later in the same wood, which I have now dumped all the casks and blended them all together. And the natural strength at 40 years old is 41.7. The whiskey, obviously any whiskies that mature beside the sea will lose far more alcoholic strength, but the volume levels are quite attractive. If this whiskey had matured on the mainland, it would have been totally different, but the alcohol strength would have been slightly higher.
And what kind of casks were these? That's the one thing you didn't mention.
They were second fill sherry casks, hogsheads. So this company always had hogsheads. I was very surprised that I hadn't seen them. As I said, they went out of business in the late 70s. So it was great to actually see these casks again, and I've taken a few shots of them, just of the casks now, of which the casks were still in good condition, and the whisky that came out of them really made me sort of say, right, let's fill them again with new make spirit. So we have done that. So they're now maturing again with new whisky in them now.
How long will we leave that for, or do you know yet?
It'll not be as long as 40 years, I don't think. I'll look at it in a few years' time and see how it's going on. I mean, I assume that the casks were still pretty active, but I may have been a bit presumptuous with that because I was really overwhelmed by the quality that came out of them already. I'll look at them in a few years' time, see if they are maturing to the way I would think them, and if they're not, I'll take them out of that and put them back into more active wood.
Now, where will this 40-year-old be available? Any idea how much it will cost? And by the way, how does it taste?
It tastes wonderful. In my opinion, of all the Bunnahabhains I've ever tasted, and that's a lot, this is the best Bunnahabhain I've ever tasted. So a price has not really been set yet. This is extremely rare. It'll be many years before we could look at doing a 40-year-old Bunnahabhain again. And it's totally unique because we never have these type of casks again. So this is really a one-off as such, although we may well see 40-year-olds again, but not from these particular style of casks. So it will be, it'll go to the top markets that Bunnahabhain has. As I said, it will be in Taiwan, and it will come to the United States, and it will obviously be on sale from the distillery and in the UK. That's as much as I know about where they'll be in sale at the moment.
Now, in the meantime, you've just brought Toychek to the U.S. for the first time, which has been out at the distillery for a couple of years and was, I guess, originally intended as a limited release. I first tried it at the Phage a couple of years ago at the distillery, but this is unusual for you guys because it's a smoky, it's a peated Bunnahabhain.
It is. You know, it's something that I'm really delighted that it's come to the States now, because it gives the consumer the opportunity to actually see the full range of what Bunnahabhain can actually do. This dates back to when we first bought the distillery, and I wanted to recreate what Bunnahabhain had been producing in the years prior to 1963, when they stopped making drying their own malted barley by burning peat fires. They took the maltings out removed the peat kilns and such, and decided they would take all the malt from the mainland and it would all be indirectly dried. So it was all, there was no smoke flavour at all. Because that was all, the decision was made then because of the requirement of blending, because it was very, I mean, the requirement of peaty whiskey, smoky whiskey in blends is very, very limited. So a very small requirement. So they doubled the size of Bunahavan and at the same time moved over to making unpeated whiskey. So when we took over the distillery, I immediately insisted, when one of the first jobs I brought in engineers to do was to put in the additional vessels so that I could separate the distillates and comfortably do the same as I did at Tobermory. By making the Lechig and Tobermory spirits, I could do the same at Bunahavan. Now, the name of the peated spirit I make at Bunahavan is called Monia. Now, Monia is the Gaelic word for peat. And the Tosh is a creation of me where I have taken sort of younger, vibrant, powerful young Monia and blended it with some mid-age sherried Bunahavan from the traditional style. And the vibrancy, the pungency of the young peaty spirit blended with the sherried influence gave it that little bit of extra depth. But what comes to the fore is there's this lovely smokiness without the iodine medicinal antiseptic qualities of some of the other islets, which makes it quite unique. And this is all comes about because of the size of the stills at Bunahavan. As you've been there, Mark, you know the size. They're enormous stills, the largest in Islay. In fact, the Wash still is the largest in Scotland. So that is one thing, you know, that which dictates that it will never be an oily spirit. And Bunahavan is that style. But it makes us a wonderful example of a sweet and smoky, fruity, with just that nice little bit of depth because of the older whiskey content in it.
And what else is happening at Bunahavan that we should know about, besides the 40, besides the Toy Chuck coming to the U.S., what else is happening there?
Well, I mean, I'm always doing experiments with all different types of casks. I only talk about the ones like most blenders talk about, the ones that are successful. The ones that are not successful, we don't speak a word about, you know. So I'm doing different trials, and we'll always bring out something special for the festival bottling. And we're reviewing our current expressions from Bunahavan. So nothing definite apart from the 40-year-old coming out later this year, but within the next few months. And I'm excited about that because that's a super product.
Now, I got to ask, tell me about one of these experiments that didn't work out. What did you try that just, you said, we are never going to do this again?
Well, you know, one of the ones that, I mean, some of the ones that work out good can also work out bad. Working with port can be really fruitful as long as you watch and don't let it sit in the port for too long. If you leave whiskey in port wood for too long, which I did, just to see what happens, what actually happens is that the whiskey extracts the real ruby colour from the port. But if you leave it for too long, it starts to actually dissolve the port colouring, so it ends up going back to what it was at. So that is quite strange, that. I've never been very fond of using rum casks. I think there's a conflict there in the different flavours, the use of the molasses or sugar cane, and I have known, it hasn't happened to me, but it has happened to other vendors, where the whiskey takes on a kind of green colour. It's not the most attractive colour, and I've never really tasted a rum finish that I've thought was very attractive, and I don't think it would suit any of the malts that we have, although technically we work in partnership with a rum company, but they might be keen to use my cask, but I certainly haven't keen to use theirs.
Now let's talk about the mainland distillery, Deanston, because it's the closest to the major tourist centers where people could get to Deanston, and you guys have been giving the distillery itself some love recently, right, with the new visitor center.
We have. The company invested close on $1 million on the new visitor center at Deanston, which allows the public and the consumers to get access to Deanston, which was never allowed before. They can see the traditional workings of this lovely old distillery, which has retained its traditional identity, which is really important in the days now where there are so many automated distilleries. Let's let people see how whiskey was made in the past, and me being a traditionalist believes it should always be.
So it's now open to the public year-round or just during the summer or when?
It's open all year round, 7 days a week. We'll be taking, there's also a lovely little coffee bothy there as well where people can enjoy some soft drinks and nice lunches. There's really nice tasting rooms where the guides take the people around the distilleries. And depending on what tour that they take, they get to the opportunity to taste some of the expressions of Deanston. I brought out two limited editions, especially for the distillery, which are only available at the distillery. They will not be given to any sales teams anywhere in the world. If anyone wants to buy these whiskies, they have to go to Deanston to buy them. Got a lovely one, which was one of my long-running experiments, which turned out to be a fantastic success. I experimented on with different toasting levels of with American barrels, American bourbon barrels, and I got them all charred to different levels. And over a 9-year period, I monitored and recorded all my findings and the whiskey of how it evolved in each different charring level. And once I had gleaned enough information, I really found how Deanston matures really well. I then blended all the casks together and ended up with 4 hogsheads, which are just refill whiskey hogsheads, and that's what we bottled one of these for the visitor centre, selling extremely well, and that goes under the name of Deanston Toasted Oak, and that is a liquid which I started doing in 1998, so that's it just been bottled now, so it's a 14-year-old liquid. The other one I done is a very rare one. I did a one cask where one time over in Spain, I was over in Gonzales Baez, and I was intrigued by the quality of their Lepanto brandy. And I was ordering different casks like Oloroso, Manzanilla, Pedro Jimenez casks, and bringing them over. And I said, just give me one cask of the Pedro of the Lepanto as well. And I brought that over, and I didn't really know, like, what one cask, what am I going to put into this? And I had to thought at the time, I'll either put Tobermory or Late Chicken. We didn't have Bunnahabhain in those days. But I thought about it, and I said, no, I think the whiskey that it'll take much from this would be Deanston. So I took a younger Deanston, it wasn't new make, and I put it into the casks, and let it mature, and this whiskey is 19 years old now. It's actually been in the Lepanto cask for it was only about 12 years, so it's like a double maturation. The result was sensational, lovely product. It's a one off. I mean, you couldn't make it again because of the time that I did that. But it's another successful experiment. It's one butt was bottled, and once it's finished. And the bottles are only for sale. And the last limited edition I brought out, very small quantity, was the opening of the visitor centre. I bottled a 37-year-old single cask Deanston, which is from a heavy sort of sherried style of Deanston, which was a really nice example. It's lovely, rich flavours. And that is only for sale at the distillery. So 3 examples. There's very little of the old one. There's still reasonable volumes of the other 2 left here because we only opened the distillery to the public in June. So there's quite a lot of the other ones left yet, but the 37-year-old, not so much of it.
Any mainstream Deanstons coming out that we need to know about?
Well, we have been toying with the fact of that we do have mature stocks of the organic Deanston, which we're one of the very few, and I was one of the very first to start making organic whisky at Dainstown, which I've been doing since the year 2000. So coming up this year, some of the liquid is up to 12 years old, but always the plan was originally we'd bring out a 10-year-old of the organic, and because the Dainstown's going through a sort of possible repackaging and such, we're looking at the whole thing, and that's probably going to be something that will go into early next year, I believe, but the organic will be coming out as well.
One of the decisions you took a while back was to change all of your whiskies at all three distilleries and go non-chill filtered, no caramel coloring at all of the distilleries. How's that been received? Because I know sales are up, and I think the market has taken to this, and I know it's something that whiskey lovers have been wanting, but how have you seen the results since then?
I think the results have been amazing. We have seen a rise in all markets where we have carried out this. This was another one of my traditional beliefs of being a traditionalist. I sort of fought against this decision that was done by marketing all those years ago. Well, not that many years ago, in the late 70s, where they wanted to make whiskey pretty by making it temperature stable and looking bright in the bottle. That'd be unaffected by the addition of ice or water, which was really driven mostly by the American market. But it was a thing that was frowned on, and so they thought, right, we want to have this temperature stable whiskey. And for me, that was just, I could never understand why we would do this. Why would a company spend so much money buying the best malted barley, being so careful in the distillation, selecting the best casks, maturing it, allowing all those lovely aromas, flavors, textures to evolve in the cask? As a blender, we select the whiskies, we say that's how we want it to be. It then goes to the bottling, and the first thing they do is chill it down to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Pass it through the filter and leave a lot of the oily, waxy compounds which give the whiskey flavour, texture and aroma, and also colour. It takes out colour as well. So,
which they then put back in with caramel.
Some of them put in with caramel. I've wanted, though we weren't the first company that have carried out the unchill filtered, but we were the first company to decide to take our entire range over three single malts of all different expressions. Everything is unchill filtered now. It was great because we got, I remember when I first spoke about this with Dave Broom. Dave was really excited about that, and him and I spent a time up at one of my labs, the one at Dainstown actually, and when I let him sample all these whiskies, he was blown away with the difference when we checked it against old against new. So much so that him and another, I think it was Rob Allinson, did a comparison and did a great article in the Whiskey magazine detailing of how much they were in favour and how much they saw the change in the whiskies that we do.
Finally, I want to talk to you about one of the blends, because we're all familiar with Black Bottle, but in many Western markets, we're not familiar with your other, actually bigger selling blend, which is a Scottish Leader, which I know is very popular in many of the Asian markets, South Africa, Australia, and a lot of markets around the world, but we never hear about it in the UK or North America. Tell me about this one, because it's one that when people are traveling, they're going to see it and they're going to wonder what it is.
Well, it's a great blend. It's a traditional old style blend. I call it like that because of the style. It's got a nice little bit of smokiness in it, which comes actually from the Lechig whisky from Tobermory. Strange one, because Scottish Leader has no Islay whisky in it at all. Nothing. And even when we purchased Bonahaven, I refused to change my formula to include Bonahaven in the recipe for Scottish Leader. Scottish Leader is available in the States. There's a good market in Texas and in California. So it's already in the States, and it's certainly got a lot of people are very fond of it. Yeah, you're right about Taiwan. It's the number one whiskey in Taiwan. It's also number one whiskey in many Eastern European countries. It sells. It's number two in South Africa. It's doing extremely well. It's one of the big fastest climbers in Scotland, and it's doing extremely well there. Yes, it's our biggest selling whiskey. It's the one that pays all the salaries.
Are you going to expand the marketing for that in the U.S. and other countries and try to take this more global?
Well, I mean, it's a massive ask to try and cut into the blended whiskey market in the States because it's such a large market and massive volumes. But we have a great team here in the States, and I know they're very enthusiastic about all the products that we have. And if they get behind Scottish Leader and take it to just one of the things about Scottish Leader is just to taste it, compare it against the other blends. That's just the opportunity, just to taste it. It's an extremely versatile whiskey. It mixes great with everything. There's so much you can do with it, and you know, there's we can't fault the determination of the team we've got here. I've seen, in fact, we go down to Texas on Friday of this week, and this is down to one of the major companies that sell Scottish Leader down there in growing and ever increasing volumes. So that, for me, is really encouraging.
You having fun?
I'm always having fun. Every time I come here, it's great. Yeah, it's never long enough. I mean, the growth of the company and the demands that I have on myself worldwide means that my trips here, which used to be 2 weeks or so, are always stuck now to about a week. So it's always quite congested of the things that we have to do. But no, it's great fun. The whiskey market, whiskey world, is great at the moment. There's a buzz about everyone. All my colleagues that work for other companies and that are all very vibrant as well. It's a good time in the whiskey world.
You'll find my tasting notes for the Boonehaven Toychuk and many of Ian's other whiskeys in our smartphone apps and at the WhiskeyCast website. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by Bal Blair. And let's start off this week with the whiskey Ian and I were just discussing, Scottish Leader Blended Scotch. It's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose on my sample is rich and fruity with notes of orange, tangerine, ginger, roasted almond, and a hint of brown sugar. The taste is thick and well-balanced with good spicy touches of cinnamon, coriander, ginger, vanilla, orange peel, and honey. The finish is lingering with orange, honey, and cinnamon notes. I'm scoring Scottish Leader an 89. Earlier this month, Marlon Paltu of New York's Park Avenue Liquor Shop told us about several of his store-exclusive bottlings. I received samples of them this week, including the Clandenny 35-year-old single grain distilled at the old Cambus Distillery in 1975. It was bottled at 54.2% ABV. The nose is crisp but woody with toasted oak, rye bread, heather, and allspice notes. The taste is spicy and intense with black pepper, licorice, allspice, and anise touches. The finish is short and aromatic with notes of anise and licorice. It's an interesting change of pace. I'm scoring the Clandenny Cambus 35-year-old single grain from Park Avenue Liquor Shop an 87. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you this time around by Bal Blair, whiskeys timed to perfection. My tasting notes are available in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android users, and at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find details on our Glenmorangie Golf Giveaway, links to our Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, my photo gallery, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases, and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2012, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.